Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello and welcome once more to the program. I must admit to browsing the internet from time to time, and recently I came across a quote from Ken Schlauber, Colorado miner and the creator of the Leadville Trail 100-mile race. And that quote reads, "Make friends with pain and you'll never be alone." And now, ain't that the truth? I thought that little bit of wisdom was especially pertinent to the end of our last program and the quote from Pema Chodron's book, Start Where You Are, A Guide to Compassionate Living. If you remember, she pointed out that the reason we humiliate or harm others is that we're in pain, and that's one way of dealing with it. We see the pain as an enemy and are wanting to pass our suffering on to someone else. It is, of course, a totally inappropriate way of dealing with it, but it's not surprising that we do it. We humans are extremely adept at finding inappropriate ways of dealing with things. And we do that, Pema Chodron points out, because we don't take the time to look deeply and compassionately at what is really going on. We see ourselves as separate and isolated from everyone else and our environment, and in our self-concern, we lose any sense of interconnectedness. She says, instead of first making friends with what we're feeling, and then second, trying to communicate, we have all these ways of keeping the us and them story solid and strong. That's what causes all the pain on this earth, including the fact that the ecosystem is turned upside down. All of that comes from people not making friends with themselves and never being willing to communicate with the one they consider to be the troublemaker. And that's how we stay caught in this battleground, this war zone. This last week, the universe must have been trying to tell me something, because in my browsing, I came across another very relevant bit of writing. This time, not by a miner and long-distance runner, but by an actual writer, one Kristen Luce. From her experience, she talks about how we create our own war zone, but how we can also bring peace by making friends with our pain. Her article is appropriately titled, Making Friends with Emotional Pain, and it starts off with an anecdote about Chogyam Trungpa and one of his students. She writes, a student once asked Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, have you ever been to hell? Yes, he replied. How did you get out? I try to stay there. Kristen Luce continues, I am the eternal optimist and have even been accused of being annoyingly chipper. I was once described as a cheerleader by a co-worker who clearly did not appreciate that characteristic in me. The truth, however, is that I have woken up most mornings for the past 30 years into what Eckhart Tolle terms the pain body. The pain body is almost like an entity that takes you over, according to Tolle. It feeds on pain, provokes it in others, and takes over your thinking. For a while, we just want to see and feel everything that's bad and wrong about others, the world, and ourselves. We seek out pain, invite it, cultivate it, stew in it, and suffer from it. And that is a pretty good description of being in hell. I often wake up with a sense of dread, anxiety, or self-blame. It started as young as I can remember, finally becoming full-blown as a teenager, and is still with me now. There's a waking scream that starts inside saying something like, I don't want to. The meaning? I don't want to wake up. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be alive. Thoughts careen around inside, tearing me down, shaming me, and telling me how I will never make it. I am not and never have been suicidal, yet most mornings I visit this place. It's like a nightmare that ambushes me when I'm at my weakest, during that liminal moment of waking up. I know from my work with clients over the past decades that it is a place many people live or visit as well. Once I finally rise, the pain is quickly shaken off. But what is interesting is that in those moments of hellish awakening, I actually don't want to get out of bed or be free at all. I want to stay in this miserable, depressed, or terrified state. That, to me, is a telltale sign of the pain body. In that place, The pain wants to feed on misery and more pain for a long while. Kristen Luce continues, I have meditated for months at a time. I have delved deeply into psychology, Buddhism, and inquiry. And wow, I've dwelled for extended periods in true bliss and life-changing transformation that took hold. Yet still, after decades, I often still wake up in hell. For a long time, I thought that if I just did enough work, became aware enough, or was somehow good enough, then peace would come to me and it would stay for good. But the answer turned out to be entirely different. I finally found a solution. It just wasn't the one I wanted to find. Instead of solving it, I welcomed it. I saw the pain like a child coming to me, mid-nightmare, wanting comfort. Utterly defeated by the relentlessness of it, I just gave in and started listening. And yes, at first, I also hoped that maybe that would make it go away. It didn't. I just wake up each morning with a scared baby mind screaming, help. And so each morning, I help. Our relationship has become more and more nuanced over time. Fundamentally, though, it's no different than when I learned to get up to pee 3 times a night when I was pregnant, or awakened in the night more times than that when I had a newborn. Pain wakes up in me and I meet it. Usually I feel it viscerally, such that it jars me out of sleep. Next, I feel the constriction, panic, dread, or intense desire to turn away. All I want is to go back to sleep in order to get away from it. Finally, slowly, words come, and they're always unfiltered, accusatory, and intense, like, I hate you. When this thought finally emerges into consciousness, my response now is, ah, there you are. And I emotionally roll into a ball, cradling my scared, angry, hurting self, and hold her. The strange answer to awakening in hell is to welcome it. Just be warned that it doesn't mean that it hurts any less. I don't mean that you should try to be artificially or insincerely happy about it, but rather, don't resist what is already happening. We are open, sensitive beings, so complex that it far exceeds our ability to understand what that means or how far and deep it reaches. Who knows why we are transmuting pain or how long it might take? Who even cares? By welcoming the pain body into my bed each morning, I lost any fear or resistance to it, and then, on some mornings, I notice that it doesn't even visit. I wake up content, at peace, and refreshed. But I'm more than fine if I don't. I look forward to meeting the pain each day. We're deep friends now. The thing I really didn't expect was that by cherishing my own pain, I could then meet the pain of others with the same level of non-resistance, acceptance, and yes, love. It's not that I enjoy others being in pain or wish it on anyone, quite the opposite. And yet, for example, I loved being there for my daughter when she was in the emergency room having her finger stitched up, even as the anesthesia wasn't working. I loved being there to meet her fear and pain, just as I meet my own. My lover came to me today, full and tangled, deep in his experience of a trigger of past pain, and even the worst, shame. It was more beautiful than I can tell you, and he seemed stunned, confused, and maybe even a little wary of my loving him in this place. Loving and caring for the parts in us that haven't known care, and maybe even haven't thought it possible that we could be loved here, in our aggression, our hurt, our humiliation, seems to bring the deepest level of healing and connection. It breaks us open, exposing everything. Even the anger, shame, and unworthiness are now ready to be seen and fully loved. When we are genuinely loved up right there, in that place, something unspeakably good happens. What I have seen is that it starts by meeting myself in just the same way. My waking up in hell has, in the end, been a kind of initiation. The way out of hell is to stay there. It's also the way to reach out a hand and a tender heart to someone else who is in hell. If there's anything that makes this whole unbelievably difficult path worth it, it's that. Now, it would be nice to sit for a moment or two just absorbing what Kirsten Luce says in this article. But the computer running this program would not allow that. Without sound, it would just switch off, I'm told. So now, as we've gone on long enough without thinking about motivation for the program today, let's think about that instead. Let's think about that instead, remembering particularly what Luce wrote in her last few sentences. The way out of hell is to stay there. It's also a way to reach out a hand and a tender heart to someone else who is in hell. If there's anything that makes this whole unbelievably difficult path worth it, it's that. Whatever we must go through, let it help us to reach out a hand and a tender heart to someone else who is suffering, who might be in their hell. And as we are all in our own kind of hell in one way or another, let our hands go out to everyone with the intention of helping them out of all suffering and into a state of eternal peace. Shall we make that our motivation for today? Let's at least try. Thank you. The last week's comments by Pema Chodron came in response to a slogan in the mind training teachings passed down from the ancient Indian master Atisha to later adepts like Geshe Chikawa and Namkar Pel. He whose text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, we've been discussing for several programs now. The actual slogan in that text appears as Don't Strike at the Vital Point, although Pema Chodron prefers Don't Bring Things to a Painful Point. It basically means do not humiliate and criticize others so that their self-esteem plummets into misery and helplessness. Having looked at Pema Chodron's commentary on this slogan, now let's see what her teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, who was mentioned in Kirsten Luce's article, has to say about the slogan. In Training the Mind and Cultivating Loving Kindness, he also uses the translation, Don't Bring Things to a Painful Point, and says, Don't blame your sense of dissatisfaction, pain, and misery on somebody else. And don't try to lay your power trips onto others. Whatever power you have, domestic power, literary power, or political power, don't impose it on somebody else. The slogan also means not to humiliate people. Don't blame your sense of dissatisfaction, pain, and misery on somebody else. From this, it's easy to see Chogyam Trungpa's influence on his student. But now let's take a longer look at his recommendation not to lay power trips on others. An interesting article on the use and abuse of power appears on the website expertbase.org. It is authored by a somewhat mysterious writer with the moniker Graham Y, and yes, that is the single letter Y. And in it, he distinguishes between position power and personal power. Position power comes from the authority given by an organization, like the power given to a CEO, for instance, while personal power he defines as the degree of influence the individual has and is given by the followers. And these two are not exclusive. People with position power will also be given personal power, while those with personal power will often be given positional power. But no matter the kind of power, Graham Wise says that problems arise when people are given substantial position power in roles they feel out of depth with and lacking in confidence. To cover themselves, they start to abuse their power with criticism, threats, intimidations, and so on. He takes this quote from John Steinbeck's The Short Reign of Pippin IV. Power does not corrupt. Fear corrupts. Perhaps the fear of a loss of power. And he says, for me, this quotation says a great deal about the two types of leader. The abusers of power are frequently out of depth in their role. They fear losing their position and the likely loss of face, status, and money. They do not feel that they can ask for help or support to improve the way they operate. Possibly, they believe it will be seen as a sign of weakness, and so they aim to compensate with what they think is a show of strength. Leaders have a right to ask things of their followers, and there are many different ways they can go about this, and there's no one right way. At times, A leader may need to be more directive and authoritative, at others, more inclusive and supportive. Whatever the situation, the leader still operates from position power, and the good one remains aware of their own personal power. Graham Wye recommends that if we have position power, we harvest a lot of personal power if we treat those under us with due respect. Accept that with your position comes responsibility, he says. Regardless of how your bosses may treat you or colleagues treat their people, it's no excuse for you to abuse your power. Remember, the most effective way to engage people and to get them work with and for you is to treat them as they want to be treated. Pay attention to your behaviors and notice if you have any tendency to make unreasonable demands or revert to authority to get things done. How difficult is it to think about the other person first and then ask for what you want in the most appropriate way? He says that we always have a choice whether we use or abuse our power. Often those with power do not realize they're abusing their power, never mind why they're doing so. But invariably, the reason is that they are uncomfortable in the role they find themselves in. He encourages us to carefully examine the power we have over others, and if we are experiencing discomfort, to look at what is making us feel that way. Then we can find what we have to do to fit the role better or to find another role. Learn to be comfortable with your power, both position and personal, and you will be pleasantly surprised what you can achieve as a leader, he says. And that is how to be careful with the power that we wield over others. But now let's go to another well-known Buddhist teacher for her take on the slogan, "Don't bring things to a painful point." In her ongoing series on the mind training teachings on tricycle.org, Judy Leaf writes, "We all have lots of faults, and it's easy to get caught up in dwelling on them. It's easy to see all the things that are wrong about everyone and everything else as well. We may feel that we're doing somebody a favor by pointing out to them where they fall short, convincing ourselves that we're only doing so for their own benefit. But focusing on people's most vulnerable areas, their most painful points, can undermine their confidence and their ability to go forward. Likewise, focusing on our own faults can be equally discouraging. What happens with this focus on the negative is that our critical attitude becomes so entrenched that we can only see what is wrong and we become blind to what is right. By critiquing other people, we may feel good about ourselves in comparison. But in order to keep feeling good, we need to keep finding new targets for our fault-finding in order to shore ourselves up. Deep down, we do not trust ourselves, so we need to keep convincing ourselves in this way." According to the slogan, instead of pouncing on people's weaknesses and vulnerabilities, we should be providing encouragement and support for their strengths. That is what we should notice and point out, not just what is wrong. The idea is that it is more skillful to encourage positive qualities than to criticize what is negative. With this approach, we're not using others to heighten our own confidence, nor are we undermining other people's confidence by reminding them of their inadequacies. You want proof? On the website www.psychologytoday.com, Dr. Stephen Stosny has an article titled, "One Thing That Will Ruin a Perfectly Good Relationship." Dr. Stosny is the founder of Compassion Power in suburban Washington, D.C., and his recent books are Empowered Love and Soar Above, How to Use the Most Profound Part of Your Brain Under Any Kind of Stress. He has appeared in various TV shows like The Oprah Winfrey Show, The Today Show, CBS Sunday Morning, and CNN's Talkback Live and Anderson Cooper 360. And he's also been the subject of articles in several newspapers and journals like The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and Reuters. He has led hundreds of workshops all over the world and has presented at most of the leading professional conferences. And he's treated over 6,000 clients for various forms of resentment, anger, abuse, and violence. And he's also taught at the University of Maryland and at St. Mary's College of Maryland. A very busy man, and he should know what he's talking about. Can you guess the one thing that he finds is the ruin of any good relationship? Now let him tell us. He writes, as Oscar Wilde put it, criticism is the only reliable form of autobiography. Dr. Stosny said it tells you more about the psychology of the criticizer than the people he or she criticizes. Astute professionals can formulate a viable diagnostic hypothesis just from hearing someone criticize. He goes on, criticism is the first of John Gottman's famous Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which predict divorce with more than 90% accuracy. In my clinical experience, it is the most predictive of disaster in love relationships, as the other three tend to follow from it. And he names defensiveness, contempt, and stonewalling as the other three, saying that defensive and contemptuous partners almost invariably feel criticized. He continues, criticism is destructive to relationships when it is about personality or character rather than behavior, filled with blame, not focused on improvement, based on only one right way to do things, and belittling. Criticism in close relationships starts out in most cases on a low key and escalates over time, forming a downward spiral with increasing resentment. The criticized person feels controlled, which frustrates the critical partner, who then steps up the criticism, increasing the other's sense of being controlled, and so on. At no time in this downward spiral does an obvious fact occur to critical people. Criticism is an utter failure at getting positive behavior change. Any short-term gain you might get from it just builds resentment down the line. Now, I think that is very important and bears repeating. Criticism fails at getting positive behavior change, and any immediate gain is short-term and fosters resentment that will rear its ugly head to bite back later on. Dr. Stosny continues, criticism fails because it embodies two of the things that human beings hate the most. It calls for submission, and we hate to submit. It devalues, and we hate to feel devalued. While people hate to submit, we like to cooperate. Critical people seem oblivious to a key point about human nature. The valued self cooperates. The devalued self resists. If you want behavior change, show value for the person whose behavior you want to change. If you want resistance, criticize. He goes on to point out that critical people are often clever enough to know that criticism doesn't actually work. So why, he asks, do they keep doing it in the face of mounting frustration? They keep doing it because criticism is an easy form of ego defense. We don't criticize because we disagree with a behavior or an attitude. We criticize because we somehow feel devalued by the behavior or attitude. Critical people tend to be easily insulted and especially in need of ego defense. Critical people were often criticized in early childhood by caretakers, siblings, or peers. Criticism can be especially painful for young children. They cannot distinguish criticism of their behavior from rejection, no matter how much we try to make the distinction for them. As in the well-intentioned, you're a good boy, but this behavior is bad. Such a distinction requires a higher prefrontal cortex operation, which is beyond most young children. To a child under 7, anything more than occasional criticism, even if soft-pedaled, means they're bad and unworthy. He goes on, the only thing young children can do to survive is attach emotionally to people who will take care of them. Feeling unworthy of attachment, as criticized young children are apt to feel, seems a bit like life or death. So they try to control the great pain of criticism by turning it into self-criticism, since self-inflicted pain is better than unpredictable rejection by loved ones. By early adolescence, they begin to identify with the aggressor, emulating the more powerful criticizer. By late adolescence, self-criticism expands to criticism of others. And by young adulthood, it seems to be entirely criticism of others. But most critical people remain primarily self-critical. I've never treated one who was not. As hard as they are on others, most are at least equally hard on themselves. Dr. Stosny says that the critical person is likely to be the last to know whether they are a critical person. He says, as the joke goes, I give feedback, you're critical. I'm firm, you're stubborn. I'm flexible, you're wishy-washy. I'm in touch with my feelings, you're hysterical. If someone tells you you're critical, you probably are. But then there's even a better way to tell. Think of what you automatically say to yourself if you drop something or make a mistake. Critical people will typically think, oh, you idiot, or jerk, or just curse or sigh in disgust. If you do that to yourself, you most likely do it to others as well. He then talks about the difference between criticism and feedback, saying, as Judy Leaf suggested, that critical people often will say and even think that they're not so much criticizing as giving helpful feedback. Dr. Stosny gives a number of ways in which criticism and feedback can be told apart. First, criticism focuses on what's wrong, as in, why can't you pay attention to the builds? Whereas feedback focuses on how to improve, as in, let's go over the builds together. Then also, criticism implies the worst about the other's personality. For example, you're stubborn and lazy. Feedback, instead, is about behavior, not personality, and he gives us an example. Can we start by sorting the bills according to due date? He goes on to say that criticism devalues, as in, I guess you're just not smart enough to do this, whereas feedback encourages. I know you have a lot on your plate, but I'm pretty sure we can do this together. Criticism implies blame. It's your fault we're in this financial mess, while feedback focuses on the future. We can get out of this mess if we both give up a few things. What do you think? Criticism also attempts to control, with words like, I know what's best, I'm smarter and more educated. But feedback respects autonomy with a kind of attitude that communicates, I respect your right to make that choice, even though I don't agree with it. Finally, criticism is coercive, like, you're going to do what I want, or else I won't connect with you, or will punish you in some way. While feedback is not at all coercive. Instead, it conveys the message, I know we can find a solution that works for both of us. Now, does this make it obvious that feedback encourages and is much more productive than criticism? Stosny does post a warning about feedback. He says, if you're angry or resentful, any feedback you give will be heard as criticism, no matter how you put it. That's because people respond to emotional tone, not intention. It's best to regulate the anger or resentment before you try to give feedback. And that is all we have time for today. Our time is now up. Thanks for joining the program, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. Please dedicate, as usual, to attaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.
is a member of